Greet each of you in Jesus' name, and we welcome the visitors. It's special to have visitors. I was blessed by the singing of that first hymn. I suppose some of you saw that the heading under it is Chautauqua, and that hymn was written by Mary, whatever the name is, as she was at one of those cottages on the lake on the east side. Jay Martin from Northeast told me that he knows which cottage she was at when she wrote it in the 1850s. But if you ever had the privilege of coming down Interstate 90 from Buffalo to Erie, you'll pass to the west of the lake. Been by it a few times, and I remember one time I'd worked all day for Martin's up there, and I was gonna come down to close to Erie and get a room and then work all day the next day on other jobs. And I came down on the east side. I think it's Highway 20, but I'm not certain of that. It was on the east side, and it was about 8 o'clock in the evening, and I came down on the side so I could look across the lake and see the setting sun, and then I understood why Mary wrote that song. It was a day like this, and the water was blue. It's about a 20, 25-mile long lake and about maybe 4 or 5 miles wide, and it's just, you drive on the east side and look to the west, and the sun is setting, day is dying in the west. And anyway, I just always think of that lake when we sing that song. All right, children, quiz time. Who was the man who had more fingers than toes than we do? How many of you found a man with a name like this? Okay, I didn't either, so you're on safe ground. But who was the man? Who was the man that had more fingers and toes than we do? Did I come up with one? Oh, here, I thought it was too hard for anybody. Go ahead, Burns.
The descendant of Goliath.
Who was it?
The descendant of Goliath.
That's correct. He was a descendant of Goliath. If you just turn in your Bibles to 2 Samuel 21. It's kind of an interesting story. Actually, I had a little trouble figuring out if he was a descendant or just a brother to him. It almost reads two different ways, but you're in the right family. So if you look at 2 Samuel 21, starting at verse 15, I'm not going to read the whole thing, but they had these battles with the Philistines. And in verse 18, one of the men, Sibiachi, the Hushinathite, slew Saph, which was one of the sons of the giant. Now, my center column says that the sons of the giant were all the sons of a man by the name of Rapha, or Rapha, R-A-P-H-A. And as you go down through this battle, there's different battles. Like in verse 20, there was another battle at Gath where was a man of great stature that had on every hand 6 fingers and on every foot 6 toes, 24 in number. He was also born to the giant. And then there was another one. And verse 22 says that these 4 were born to the giant, which is this Rapha, and fell by the hand of David and by the hand of his servants. One of the brothers, it says he was the brother of Goliath. So I'm not sure if he's a descendant or a brother. It just was this family. Everybody was a whopper. But this fella here had an extra finger back here, I guess, or maybe one in between here. I don't know where it was, but when they counted, they came up with 12 over here. And they looked down at his feet, they came up with 12 more. And so he was unique in several ways. It probably had something to do with the genetics of why the family was different than everybody else. But he was the one that had, I don't know if he could hold a bigger bow that way or a bigger shield, or maybe he could run 2 swords with all them fingers. I don't know. You let your mind wander and say, that would be interesting to meet that man sometime. But not around. Every now and then, there's people yet today that are born with extra. I've heard of people that have an extra finger, an extra toe, but I'm not sure that I've ever heard of someone that had all extra 4, 24 in total. All right. Question for tomorrow night. This one is the one I got from my dad, and he told me this one time, and it sounded so strange. I wasn't sure if he knew what he was talking about. But I'll ask the question, and you see if you can find the answer, and then we'll look at something that's a little bit strange. The question is this: what happened to the man who fled from a lion and then a bear. What happened to the man who fled from a lion and then a bear? It's not going to be found in Genesis. I'll give you that clue. See if you can find it and tell us tomorrow night what happened next. All right, let's sing our theme song. Am I supposed to lead it? Is that why you left the pitch pipe up here? I'll blow the pitch. Why don't you start it? Let's sing verses 1. Oh, let's see. We've been kind of mixing this up a little bit so we don't have to sing all 5 every night. Let's sing verses 1, 2, and 4. That looks like E to me.
Come, Holy Spirit, come.
Comfort to know that a helper, a comforter, a gift of God is in our midst and in our hearts, even just to help have this service, the preacher to preach, the people to listen, to meditate and digest. And God is good to have given us of himself to dwell in us. All right, let's go back to Luke 15. We're going to look at the second lost parable. Maybe I'll just read verses 1 and 2 because that is the introduction that brought on these parables, and then we'll drop down to verse 8 to verse 10. Luke 15, 1, then drew near unto him all the publicans and sinners for to hear him, and the Pharisees and scribes murmured, saying, This man receiveth sinners and eateth with them. And he spake this parable unto them, saying, dropping down to verse 8, Either what woman, having 10 pieces of silver, if she lose one piece, doth not light a candle and sweep the house and seek diligently till she find it? And when she hath found it, she calleth her friends and her neighbors together, saying, Rejoice with me, for I have found the piece which I had lost. Likewise I say unto you, there is joy in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner that repenteth. So as I told you last evening, we have this situation where publicans and sinners are drawing near. They're coming close. Their interest is there, and they'd rather be listening to Jesus than going to the tavern. They'd rather be listening to Jesus than going to the football game. They'd rather be listening to Jesus than even going to Walmart or Dollar General. This is what they wanted to do. And in they came, and their attention was there. But off to the side is the religious hierarchy. I guess that's the right word to use. Pharisees and scribes. And they're muttering, and they're saying, what's going on here? What in the world? This man receiveth sinners and eateth with them. And that was supposed to be a condemnation, but technically it was a praise. Because it's the best thing in the world that Jesus could do with a sinner. Receive them and eat with them. But Jesus saw a teaching moment. He saw a time where he was going to have to bring light to some darkness. And so he told stories, and he told three of them. And we want to look at the second one. Last night we looked at a shepherd that it goes out to find the lost. He doesn't spare effort. He goes and he goes and he goes some more. He searches long and hard. But the one that is out is eventually found. And he brings him home, and everyone rejoices. Heaven rejoices. The neighbors rejoice. He rejoices. Heaven rejoices. And you have that same conclusion, that same summary at the end of verse 10 that I read to you. But now Jesus has shifted gears, so to say. He may have, if he had a spotlight, he may have moved it to a different spot. I don't think this is a situation so much where Jesus told a story and, oh, that one was kind of a dud, I'll try again. I think it was more that as he was telling these stories, you see, I told you last night that parables have the benefit of circumventing the inner defenses of the heart and going around and injecting truth into it. And so what I think is happening here, this is the conclusion that I came to, and I know there's at least some people that agree with the conclusions I came to, but I think what Jesus is doing is he's actually, with that crowd that is gathered around him, he is actually telling other stories, because each story is going to be a ministry to a different group that is standing there. That's why there's three. So he tells the second story about a woman and 10 coins. And she has these 10 coins. She lives in a house. And one of them she loses. And you know how we lose stuff around the house. No, we don't know how. It's all of a sudden we don't know where it is. Now, where did I put my cell phone? Somebody ring it. Somebody call it so we can figure out where this thing's at. Where did I put the checkbook? I don't know. You had it last week. How does stuff get lost in the house? The best thing to say is it just happens. I don't know how she lost this coin, but she did lose it. Now, there are some differences between sheep and coins, and there's some differences in the search. You will see as you lay the two parables beside each other. But let's just talk about the coin for a little bit. Now, I brought you can't see because of the distance, but this is a quarter. And a quarter is a coin. But first point to consider here is that a coin has value. There's a couple different metals here. I think if you chop it in half, you might find copper in the middle, and there's probably silver on the outside, but it's worth 25 cents. But it's worth 25 cents. It's good for a gumball and a machine. It's two of them might get you a rubber ball and another machine. There's value here. I don't know how this woman came by this coin. I don't know that that's necessary part of the story, but she had them, and they were valuable to her. They were so valuable that when one-tenth of the pile of coins disappeared, that became her prerogative. That became her drive. That became her mission to go find the one of the 10 that was gone. That's how valuable it was. It was so valuable that even a tenth of it disappearing was something to chase, something to go find, something to pursue. Let's look at this coin some more and just let our minds wander. So this is the object lesson that Jesus is using. It's valuable. But I want to tell you something else. This coin is static. This coin isn't able to help itself. If I lay it here, it'll stay there. It is, what is static? Well, it's lacking in movement, action, or change. It has no incentive. It has no intelligence to move or to change. There it is. It's a coin. Now, the other thing I want to say about a coin is it's valuable and it's static. In other words, there it is, can't help itself, but it's also vulnerable. Did you ever see the machines at gift shops where you can put a penny in and just run it through and crush the living daylights out of it, change it into something else? That coin has no defense against the crusher. None. It's vulnerable. It is It is unable to respond to the forces pressed upon it. It's a coin. While it has value, it is static and it can do nothing by itself. You can do, I can throw this coin up in the air, I can chuck it into the fan, I can throw it out the window, I can stick it under here. This coin is vulnerable. That's a word that I attach, but I think you understand. Now, this coin also has no way to actually self-evaluate. It can't look at itself and say, oh my, I say 2021 on me. I have, is it Washington on here? I don't know the busts of my presidents very well. I think it's Washington, but it doesn't know that, and it can't figure that out. A ton of reality is impervious to this coin. It just can't figure much out. There's no introspection capabilities in that coin. And Jesus uses coins to tell a story about lost things and how they have to be found. So if he's moving from people group to people group, and the first one was the wandering sheep, who is the defenseless coin? Who is the vulnerable coin? I came to the conclusion about 20 years ago that all of a sudden he's starting to talk about the little ones in the house of Israel. Children, if you please. Oh, wait a minute. Jesus had a conversation about lost children? He probably should have, because it's true. Our coins, our children, are valuable but vulnerable. They're helpless but here. You see, this coin did not get lost out in the marketplace. It was lost in the house of the woman. Okay? Right inside her domain. Right there where she was every day. Here is the coin. It's there, but it's gone. And it's lost. And the lady of the house takes the responsibility. This is not a shepherd now that's going to go climb mountains. It is a woman of the house that is going to get the broom out. And you let your mind wander of that parable and what it's presenting. And I saw a very valuable lesson for my own consideration as a parent. I see the coins as children of the house. Is a child a coin? Well, in a parabolic sense, yes. Because it is, as I said, valuable. Do you know what Genesis 33:5 says? Well, that's the story of Jacob meeting Esau. And Jacob is coming up with family and cattle and sheep and oxen and the whole bit. And Esau is dumbfounded that the boy that, well, the old man, he could have been 60 years old when he left home. But the man that left alone is coming back with an army. And who are these children? Well, Jacob says, now he's a changed man. He says, it's the children whom the Lord hath given me, which are for wonders and signs. It's a tall, but it gives you the understanding of the value of these souls. There's a sense in which the coin is even more valuable than the sheep, when you put it that way. Psalm 127:3 says, lo, children are an heritage of the Lord. Now that means that it's valuable because the word heritage means something inherited, an heirloom or a possession. And what the psalmist is saying is that children are an heirloom or a something inherited, which the Lord has given me, or a possession. And it's a valuable possession. Just ask any parent. Most of them, at least the ones in their right mind, will tell you the value of children. They feel it, they know it, they live with it, and they will, most of them, particularly godly men and women, will give their lives for their children. That's how valuable they are. Isaiah 8:18 talks about the children whom the Lord hath given me, and these are just scriptures that point to us of the value of the coin that Jesus was talking about. Now, I talked about the vulnerability. The coin can't do anything for itself. You lay it down and it doesn't. Can children help themselves? Not as much as they think. Do you remember Jonah, the story of Jonah? At the end of that, when Jonah has done that which is his duty to do, and he's unhappy about it because the results weren't what he had hoped for, then he begins to come into contention with Jehovah God himself. And they end up with a conversation, and the conversation ends at the end of... I can't even find Jonah all of a sudden. Here we go. This story ends with a question mark of God, and it goes like this. And should I not spare Nineveh, that great city, wherein are more than 60,000? I see a score is 20. So 120,000 persons that cannot discern between their right hand and their left hand, and also much cattle. He's talking about the little ones that don't know that L stands for left. Right. Okay. Shouldn't I have mercy on the city for those little ones that can't tell left from right? Yeah. And we understand. We look at Psalm 103, verse 13, where the scriptures say, like as a father pitieth his children. We're supposed to understand that fathers pity their children. Well, it's true. Fathers do pity, at least the good ones do. The responsible ones do. The kind of fathers that seek for their coins do. They pity their children. Where does the pity come from, then? Why? Well, because the children can't help themselves. I mean, they think they can, but they will grow up to understand that they didn't. Okay? But Numbers 14:3, there was a prayer that went up and said, you know, Lord, you're not taking care of us. Our children are a prey. Means that they were meat for the coyotes. It's probably not the best way to say it, but it's a graphic picture of how these parents felt of being in the wilderness and their children were exposed. Their coins couldn't help themselves. Proverbs 29:15 is a verse about child training, but it makes this point in a pretty serious way. It says that the rod and reproof give wisdom, but a child left to himself bringeth his mother to shame. In other words, a child left to himself who can't help himself is going to self-destruct. Now, I added some words in there to help you understand the whole thought, but it's the way it is. A child left to himself will self-destruct. They can't help themselves. They're not smart enough. They're not skilled enough. They don't understand enough. They don't have the capacity to do. And there, God, in his divine design, places women with candlesticks and brooms and dads too. No child becomes wise and virtuous by pursuing his own inclinations. The only way that a child becomes wise and virtuous is by faithful instruction and discipline. That's what it's saying. The rod and reproof give wisdom, but a child left to himself bringeth himself to shame. You know, one of the things that I had to learn as a newbie parent, and everybody else does too, is that there is a graphic sense in which the child that the Lord has given us is a ticking time bomb. They will self-destruct themselves and their society unless somebody with a broom and a light gets in the way. It's the way it is. And it grieves me to watch the psychologists and the sociologists of our day come up with these bizarre ways of sweet-talking and crooning your children into paths of goodness, because it's nonsense. It's utter rot. The scripture said long before these people were born that the way you take this vulnerable, undisciplined, can't help itself, can't decide between left and right, needs to be pitied child, is to correct it and bring it up. And you know, children do not see, just like this coin really is not aware. You could set this coin out here on the street, and it will not know that the steamroller is coming until it crushes it. They're just not aware. And there's a lot of that in all of us in the first few years of our life. Well, Jesus is teaching. While he's teaching about finding lost things and getting heaven to rejoice, he says, the woman goes and finds the coin. Okay? And we want us to talk about how do you find a lost coin. And I'm not actually talking so much about child training tonight. While I believe that child training sets a stage for finding your children, I don't think that just because a child is disciplined, he's saved. Okay? I still think the decision for Christ and to be carried home on the shoulders of the shepherd is out there yet to come. But I'm telling you that it's the behavior of the woman with the broom that makes that possible. Okay? How do you find lost coins? Well, we'll just use the example of the woman to open our understanding. It says that she loses one piece, doth she not light a candle? This is the concept. This is the parabolic truth of equipping yourself with light or with truth. Here you have this house, and there's a coin lost in it. Nine are spoken for, one is lost. And we need light to find it. If I would, I know you children would enjoy this game, but if I would take this quarter and I would tell you all to go out and then I would hide it in this room, but I would turn the lights out, do you think it would take you longer to find it with the lights out or with the lights on? Oh, that's an easy question. You'd find it much quicker with the lights on, and that's how it is for finding anything. If you look for something in the dark, it's terribly hard to find. Well, you need to fill the search area with light. Now, this woman knew that the coin was right here in the house. And so she probably threw the door open. Now, she didn't have LED lights. They didn't have them in Jesus' time. So she probably threw all the doors and windows open. And then she says she lit a candle. But I can see her saying, we got to find this thing. And whatever curtain was across the doorway was flung back. And whatever was hanging across the windows was pushed back. And we were getting as much light in there as possible. I'm going to see if we can make that thing twinkle with light. You fill the light area with a light that is not there. So she's lighting this candle because the natural light is not enough to do the job. And this is how it is when we search for our coins, and that is, there is an earthly wisdom that provides a certain spectrum of light, but it's not enough to find coins. And she lights a candle. Light is the presence of God. Read 1 John 1 and understand. And so here we have this woman that wants to find a coin, and the first thing she's going to do is she's going to become a light gatherer. She's going to open up the place, and then she's going to go and even add light to it. She lights a candle. How can I light a candle to find a coin? This is where the focus is going to turn on the behavior of the woman way more than the coin. So we're going to talk a little bit about this woman and how she does so that I can understand how a parents working together, of course, could work together and find the light, find the coin with light. You see, this woman takes her candle and she carries it. She brings the light first to herself and then she takes it to the coin. Well, that's logical. You can understand that parallel, that symbolism. Know the light first before you can give it to your child. Yes. Fellowship with God is light. That's what 1 John 1 is going to say. If you have a fellowship with him, you're in the light. And so the question begs to be asked, if I'm going to be a coin searcher, do I have the light? And it's a very reasonable question. I told you that children aren't very smart. And I told you that children watching their parents are pretty vulnerable. But one thing they are good at, and that is sniffing out if mom and dad are for real. They're right up there with us. A child can figure a person out as easy as the grandpa can. And if we're going to search for coins, this thing of fellowshipping with the Lord. So does your child know how you feel about Bible reading? The coin you're searching for, do they have any inkling what your attitude toward Sunday morning worship, going to revivals? supporting, going out and doing the street meetings. More is caught than is taught. Did you ever hear that? So did I. And it's true. And so when you start talking about going and searching for a coin, and we're going to light this candle, it has to be my candle. And we have to be a person that uses the light, the word. Thy word is a lamp to my feet, the psalm says. And we have to be a person. And I hope that the coins you are looking for understand already, even though they may not have been found, that mom and dad are book readers. This one, okay? In the years we went to Bible school, we got a lot of feedback of what went on in the home through the youth. Just about every son that I interviewed knew whether his dad read his Bible on a regular basis. They just knew it. They just, when it happens, I mean, most dads don't go up in the haymow and crawl into a fort to read their Bibles. They do it in the corner of the living room. They do it back in their office. And there's just, maybe he does it before some of them get up. But there's going to be some mornings when they come down to the office and dad is on his knees. Okay? And this is one of the ways you light the light. It's true of moms too. Many a child, it might be the middle of the afternoon when they put the children down for naps, and now is your chance. And this one doesn't lay down after all, and the little child comes back, and there's mom. That's one way. But I'm talking about how you light a candle, and you light it by grasping it and carrying it yourself. One of the things that this coin can perceive is whether dad and mom use this book and its directives, its precepts, and its commandments as a guidance for their own life. And they know if I have faced problems and I go look for that problem in the light. Search the scriptures. Ask another brother and try to get some of his light on my problem. What does the Bible say? Most coins know the reality of that every day. And we could ask the question, do the coins in my world see me living the reality of Christian experience? The reality of striving and surviving and then excelling and overcoming, but perhaps failing, but repenting and going on. This is real stuff, and coins can pick up, even though they might be laying way back in the corner in the dark. They can still pick up what's going on. Does my child see me as a reflection or a carrier of the light? In the way I do Christian service, in my time choices, you know, I have some memories from my childhood of watching my parents live their lives or other people live their lives. I was thought of a memory that happened in about the mid-80s. I think I was somewhere in the range of 12 to 14 years old, but one fall evening, there was a bad man in our community, and at 10 o'clock, he set a barn on fire, and 20 minutes later, about 4 miles away, he set another one on fire, and about 20 minutes later, that he set another one, and within about a six or seven mile radius, oh, that's too big, but a 4 mile radius, there were 3 barns burning, and the county was in chaos because fire trucks would head for one fire and turn around and go to the other one, and there wasn't enough water in the ponds, and it was just a terrifically kind of a bad night from 10 o'clock to 11 o'clock. The next day, it wasn't a question of what were we going to do today. It was going to be where were we going to go help. And Dad took us boys over to the one about the closest one. It was a Weaverland conference man, and it was, you know how it is when everybody gets there and there's volunteer help. They're not real motivated to just jump right in. They got to talk about this for a while, and we're kind of standing around in groups, and then the excavators came. Okay, we're going to start cleaning up. And about that time, one of the dads came over to the boy group that I was standing in. And he said, "Come on, boys, we got more important things to do," and he left. And the rest of us stayed there and cleaned up the barn. And even in my young teen mind, there was something that niggled, and I thought, that is weird. That's how I thought back then. That was weird. I wonder how that's going to work out. And by the time I was 21, I was watching to see what those boys that he picked away from the volunteer job, because they had more important things to do. They were just farmers. They had hay to do and stuff like that. I don't think the light was shining too bright right in that moment. Okay? And that's what I'm talking about, that we, if we're going to go search for these coins, the light must first be here. My dad used to tell us, when there was a medical need and it was time to pass the offering, he would say, boys, make sure you do your part. He said, I need to tell you a secret I've learned, and that is that he who will not give shall have it taken from him by the master. That's what my dad believed, and that's what he told us. And I still think about that when it's time to pass the offering at 50-some years old. He who will not give will find it taken from him by the master. That's light shining on a coin is what's going on right there. So you deliberately place the light in the area of the lost coin. This is not something where this woman was going around the house and landing candles on each shelf to see if she could light up the house. She actually took the light and she brought it along. And she was a good cleaner. Broom in one hand and candle in the other. So she was good at what she was doing. But it's that whole idea of, I'm looking for a coin, and so I'm focusing on that. And if the coin is really our children, they're not really lost in the physical sense. So we know which bed to go find them in the morning. But this is the idea of being focused in our search, in our training, in our teaching, and in our transmission of light. Now, the second thing, first you light a light, and you make it, bring a candle. And the second thing this woman does is she goes and she sweeps the house. This is the idea of removing the dirt. If you get all the, if you take away everything that shouldn't be there, it's a whole lot easier to find what might be there. That's one of the ways that even farmers will look for tools in their shop. They'll just clean up. And lo and behold, under the panel they ripped off the combine while they were busy, there lays the half-inch adjustable wrench. And by cleaning up, you find what's lost. And this is kind of what the woman does. And we could be hard on her and say, well, what's her problem that she has such a dirty house? Well, you're not being fair with the world we live in. Have you ever noticed that dirt comes into the world just by having the sun come up the next day? It's about the way it goes. I mean, in any building, in our house, in our barn, in our garage, I have noticed that all you got to do is just have the sun come up and the sun go down, and then it gets dirty. It's a dirty world. And so for her, cleaning was such a wise thing to do. But the reality was that if I'm going to find that which is lost, I have to deal with the dirt. And so she gets busy. And I suppose there's some times that dirt comes from neglect. But if we're going to find a lost coin, let's understand that we're dealing with the dirty world. Now, to sweep the house is where you go in and there's just this activity that's around. You know the coins in the house, so all the cleaning is concentrated on finding the coin. And here we have this action. She's not sitting on her phone blogging about how to find coins. She's actually going to coins, okay? She's not running over to the neighbors and announcing to them, let's have tea together, I want to clean my house. She's just cleaning her house. And that's not as, we have ways of getting distracted and then the dirt builds up. But to sweep the house requires active involvement. Deuteronomy 6:6-7 has that picture of looking or teaching your children. And he says that you do it when you're walking in the way, and they did a lot of walking. You do it when you sit by the way, and they did more sitting than we usually do. And they'll do it when you lie down. And some very intimate pictures in that little teaching principle. But it means that the search is going to go on in all aspects of life. And then the third thing we do after sweeping the house is we search diligently. There's a consistency. One of the most inspirational conversations I ever had about raising children was with a coworker about, 15, 20 years ago. When I first started at Martin's, he and I ran together as a team delivering appliances, and then he kind of moved on. He still works in the company, and so do I, but our paths don't interact at all. But I met him a number of years later. He was at another store, and I was there. Well, how are you doing? All doing fine. Well, what are you doing with yourself? And his answer has always rang in my ear. He said, well, I'm raising a family right now. And he was. And I look at that family. He's now a grandpa, and I know the family a little bit. And I see godly children that have grown up, and they're married into godly relationships, and they're raising children. And I keep thinking about that must have all paid off, that focus. What are you doing with yourself? Well, I'm raising a family right now. And that was enough. That's plenty. That can feel like too much some days. But he was raising a family. Search diligently to look for them. And really what's going on is there's going to be, okay, first you get the light, and then you give the light, and you shine the light, and you do the cleaning. And basically what's happening is, yes, there is discipline. Yes, there is child training. Yes, there is punishments for wrongdoing. But the end goal is to have heaven rejoice. And whether you ever stop to think about this or not, heaven doesn't make that much noise if my children just turn out to be nice guys. That isn't really that much of an accomplishment. The world can do that without the gospel. But what we're really looking for is to have sons and daughters that say, yes, Lord, and the shepherd carries them back, and heaven rejoices. And they begin to embrace the light and the life that was ours. And by us having it and using it and applying it, that dedication to truth, application, here is the spot. And we take our children, and everyday experiences become teaching moments, this and that. And you know, all afternoon I'm sitting there at the table, and I'm just thinking, and I'd rather not try to figure out how well I've done with my search. It was more enjoyable to just look back at my father that I appreciate and value and see how well he did in this area. And I think of all the times and the way he taught us. He probably wouldn't want me to tell this story, but when I was a little boy, 5 years old, two congregations went together and bought an old school building. And he told the boys later, he was kind of giving us a lecture to appreciate school. And maybe he shouldn't have done this, but he did. He told us that we should appreciate what we have. He said, there's a number of us that sold out valuables of what we had so we could buy that for you. The farmers sold heifers. That's called sacrificing your future. And there were businessmen that sold off tools, and they generated the cash to buy this old building. And there were times as I went to that school, the first 9 years of my schooling, that I just thought it wasn't a very good school. But my attitude was tempered by the reality that it was there by parents who sacrificed to get it to us. And you know, when the day came that it was time for me to send a first grader down the road, I started to ask myself questions like, should I be selling anything around here to make this work? And that comes from a person that while he was searching for a coin, he was shining light. Okay? And this is the kind of thing that every parent will have to do if they're going to find these valuable, vulnerable, unable to help themselves, but precious coins. And they can be found. In the story, it was found. I'd like to believe they can always be found, but not quite every story has a happy ending. It is a fallen world, and I don't always know how to rationalize that. But that should not stop us from hearing the parable of Christ and bringing it down into our own homes, and us parents seizing the responsibility, getting the light, and then shining the light, scrubbing the place down. We're looking for our children. What are you doing? I'm raising a family. And the end goal is to have heaven rejoice in the presence of God over one sinner that repents. For all our children are sinners. They're like us. All we like sheep have gone astray. And every parent who wants to raise his children for the Lord has to understand that they are raising a sinner. It's true. Oh, wait, they're so cute. They're cute sinners sometimes. But we're raising sinners. And even though they're safe under the blood of the new covenant, the day will come where that boy or that girl has to make its own decision. Will I follow Jesus, yes or no? And the heart cry of the mother or the heart cry of the woman who is scrubbing with the broom is to find that coin and have that coin say yes. And then heaven rejoices. Angels sing, a sinner has repented. And I think that's what the second parable was about. Thank you for coming. We'll be back again. I intend to go home tonight, get some things, bring my son and my wife again. We plan to be back. You should too. Let's stand for dismissal.